I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Ines Stepman.
I'm Will Chamberlain.
And I'm Emma Waters.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, as always, we've got a diverse array of juicy topics for you this week. Will is going to kick us off by talking about the unanimous, or maybe not so unanimous, Supreme Court ruling with respect to the efforts in Colorado to kick former President Donald Trump off the ballot. Inez will talk about the fight for the successor to Mitch McConnell in the Senate. I'll talk a little bit about recent significant developments in some of the J6 prosecutorial or persecutorial efforts ongoing in Washington, D.C. And last but not least, Emma will take us home to talk a bit about the debate over IVF in the wake of the recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling. So with that, let's turn it over to Will first.
Okay, so yesterday, March 4th, we had Trump v. Anderson come down from the Supreme Court. It was a very quickly issued per curiam decision, which in my view, sometimes can mean a variety of things, but in my view means that this is, they thought that ultimately the majority of the court thought this was pretty silly and that they didn't need to bother, you know, assigning authorship of this opinion. But effectively there was a 9-0 on the bottom line conclusion, which is that states do not have the authority to use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to bar candidates for federal office from the ballot on the grounds that they're insurrectionists. So that basic idea got 9 votes, that what the state of Colorado did and what the state of Maine did, even though they aren't living in this case, what some judge in Illinois just did, the idea that states on their own accord, you know, on their own initiative can make the determination that somebody's an insurrectionist and needs to be kicked off the ballot, that's just total legal nonsense. Now, there were some concurring opinions and some opinions that didn't agree with everything that the majority said. The majority went a little further and said, not only are the states wrong, but the only way that you could use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to bar an insurrectionist is by having Congress pass authorizing legislation. The three liberal justices and Amy Coney Barrett didn't agree with that. They said that wasn't presented and that they would reached too far. But that's still the majority opinion in this case and the opinion of the court. And so basically what that does is it means that there isn't going to be anybody else, you know, using Section 3 to try and eliminate Donald Trump from the ballot unless Congress actually passes authorizing legislation. It's the only way. And it really does eliminate the potential for further silly litigation in the next few months. It's remarkable that it got this far. I mean, all this originated from one law review article by a couple of law professors who said that the 14th Amendment was self-executing. I believe one of those professors was William Bowdy, and I don't remember the other guy. But they wrote this law review article, I want to say about 9 months ago, that was published about 9 months ago, that, you know, got everybody in a tizzy and started all this, led to various Secretary of States kicking Trump off the ballot. And it's good that 9 months later, we now see that all this was absolutely asinine and silly. Tons of MSNBC pundits and CNN pundits are furious and are, you know, Michael Luttig, Norm Eisen, they're all just acting like the Supreme Court was way out there. Some of them are engaging in the cope to suggest that, well, because in the Colorado case, in Colorado itself, there was a finding that the president was an insurrectionist, the Supreme Court could have, you know, disturbed that finding, and they didn't. And that somehow is indicative of the Supreme Court not being pro-Trump or not doing something important. That's, of course, silly. The Supreme Court doesn't even discuss factual issues when the entire case can be reversed on a legal question. They just don't ever do that. And the funny thing is all these liberal pundits know that. They're not complete idiots. So they're aware that nothing that the Supreme Court did has any bearing on that question or that they even care. The Supreme Court's just dismissing this entire effort as stupid. Good for them, bad for all these liberal pundits. And I mean, it's another, you know, Donald Trump's on a comeback, right? We're about to see, he's been doing very well in these legal cases. I mean, the Fannie Willis thing continues to go in his direction. And this is obviously a big W, a unanimous court decision over, you know, overturning what the Colorado Supreme Court did. And I think in general, the sort of bottom line here is that you know, 6 months ago, it looked like some of the Democrats' lawfare against President Trump was going to work. There were just so many cases and so many problems he was dealing with that you had to think, man, this is going to be rough in terms of getting through to the election without getting kicked off the ballot or getting arrested, getting imprisoned. 6 months later, right now, he's actually looking pretty good. It's looking unlikely that anything except the New York case is going to go to trial. The New York case has the biggest problems of any of the cases, and he's looking like he's in good shape. And I'm really happy to see so many legal pundits who, you know, embarrass themselves, get humiliated for their judgment. You know, in one particular, Neil Katyal, who's a professor of law at Georgetown, former assistant solicitor general, former acting solicitor general, has this bizarre Jekyll and Hyde act where on the one hand, he's like a serious Supreme Court advocate that takes, you know, argues five cases a term. And on the other hand is just this rabid, ridiculous MSNBC pundit with like towing the progressive line. I don't know how he does it. It's like magic. Nobody else manages to pull that balancing act off. But he too, despite the 9-0 against him, is sitting there talking about, you know, the failure to reverse the finding that the court, you know, that Trump is an insurrectionist. Absolute nonsense. And he shouldn't be embarrassed and ashamed of himself. And with that point on my old professor, I'll let you all jump in.
Yeah, I only disagree with one part of Will's analysis, and that's that there's no one to compete with that idiocy. I would put Lawrence Tribe with that, like sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde schism. I mean, there's been nothing more disappointing than going from reading Lawrence Tribe's constitutional law textbooks about the Warren Court to watching what the guy says on TV and tweets. I mean, just incredible. It's like even on the subject on which they are professionally, undeniably like competent and smart, it's like an alien takes over their brain, and it's really a remarkable experience. But anyway, aside from that, I do think actually the sort of unanimous, I'm not going to try to pronounce unanimity, there we go, among legal commentators, mostly everywhere, you know, other than right-wing media, other than conservative media, there really wasn't that much pushback against this, even among the legal commentariat leading up to it. And that's why this 9-0 decision, I think, is pretty resounding, is a kick in the teeth. I'm honestly surprised Sotomayor. I thought it would be 8-1. I'm honestly surprised Sotomayor couldn't, you know, stomach some rationale for being on the other side. But I do think this is very good for the institution of the court. As much as we don't like to hand this guy victories on this show, I think this is a victory for John Roberts. He was able to pull together this unanimous majority. It is an important piece of maintaining the court's legitimacy. And the evidence of that is that some of the response from the left has been, including Keith Olbermann and elsewhere, has been, we need to defund the court. We need to destroy the Supreme Court, right? Exactly, because it's only confirmed for those people the institutional capacity of the Supreme Court is something that they don't want to deal with. But overall, I think a sort of white pill decision showing that there are still some strictures in the U.S. system. We are definitely stress testing just about every piece of the U.S. constitutional system right now. And we definitely don't live in anything like what the founders imagined. That being said, a lot of these traditions, they do die hard. Even something like packing the court that is technically constitutional, even an extremely popular four-term president, FDR, had that fly back in his face because there's just this gut instinct among the American people that that looks like self-dealing. It quote-unquote looks unconstitutional, even though it technically is not. I think some of those supports are still in place, and that's certainly a nice thing to see after seeing so many of them crumble in the last, you know, 4 to 6 years in the attempt to get Trump. So a bit of a white pill to start our week this time.
Yeah, certainly so. So hopping off that briefly too, as we're going into Super Tuesday today, the impact of this decision, I think, cannot be understated for the, I think, around 4.5 million voters in Colorado that were impacted by this, right? And so now they will have the opportunity to place a vote for Trump should they want. And notably that this decision also extends to Maryland as well. So Maryland's attempt to keep President Trump off the ballot there has now been voided by the Supreme Court decision. So I think from the perspective of the voters and for providing clarity going into Super Tuesday and also different aspects of the election. This was a huge win. I mean, it's certainly, I think, going to help Trump in all of his legal cases throughout the year. Usually like one domino, be it in the right direction or in a bad direction, can help set the momentum for how future decisions are perceived and the energy behind the campaign. Yeah, so I just concur with Inez. This is like a huge white pill to start off the day and also Super Tuesday itself.
So I will concur in the positive sentiments around the case and then provide a little bit of sobriety at the end. So obviously the headline takeaway is the unanimity aspect of this, the 9-0 part, which I wasn't necessarily expecting. And I'm surprised to Inez's point that Sotomayor, Brown Jackson, et cetera, did not ultimately dissent in this case. However, I do think that the unanimity is somewhat facial in this case because you have the three most left-wing judges referring to the majority as the majority in this. They don't refer to it as a unanimous case because they want to distance themselves from aspects of the ruling as well. And we can have an academic argument about whether the judges should have gone further than they did. Amy Coney Barrett herself suggested that the majority, so-called, might have done better not to weigh in more broadly as they did. And her concurrence, by the way, I think is somewhat troubling because what Amy Coney Barrett said is essentially we need to write opinions to take down the temperature, essentially acknowledging the political heat around the Supreme Court. And that is not the way that the Supreme Court ought to operate. The Supreme Court ought to operate on the merits, not with respect to the politics. And that leads me to the potential downside, which is the New York Times, maybe they're wish casting, but maybe they know something that we don't, has already written about the fact that, and this would be consistent with everything we know about the Roberts Court to date, that securing a unanimous opinion here is part of some kind of grand bargain that's going to allow the court to backslide when it comes to the presidential immunity case, potentially, with the obstruction of an official proceeding case, which will implicate, of course, Donald Trump, because in the Jack Smith D.C. January 6th related case, two of the charges relate to obstruction of an official proceeding and whether that's applicable with respect to January 6th. So I think we ought to celebrate it undeniably, the fact that it was 9-0 and that some semblance of a republic and a democratic republic exists in this country and that the Supreme Court stood in the breach and helped secure it. However, there is the potential for backsliding here. And you know, the last thing I'll say is, beyond the fact that obviously Democrats in the House like Jamie Raskin are already talking about ways that they can try to brand Trump an insurrectionist, I do think this may well increase the odds of Jack Smith, even though it will only further tarnish his reputation. I do think it increases the odds that maybe he issues a superseding indictment and charges Donald Trump pertaining to insurrection. We'll see if that occurs or not. But on that note, let's transition over to Inez, who will talk a little bit about Mitch McConnell leaving as the majority leader, or minority leader rather, in the Senate.
Well, it's certainly the end of an era. This November, after the election, McConnell will step down. He'll serve out the remainder of his term into 2027, but not in his capacity as party leader in the Senate. He is 82. He has had some interesting health episodes, much like the president. He has had freezes and he has not looked well. So this is not a totally unanticipated decision. But it is worth noting that, and these numbers are from about a year ago, so before the border bill, McConnell is the only Republican in leadership who has a negative approval rating among voters in his own party. He had a 60% overall disapproval rating among the American people and a 6% approval rating. So he is somebody who is deeply unpopular, not just obviously with his political opponents, but with voters in his own party. And I think that goes to the heart of his legacy. Obviously, there are upsides for conservatives in McConnell's legacy. The first thing that everyone will say, right, is his role in confirming judges and really transforming the judiciary. That is something that he can put in his pocket as a legacy that will affect and continue to affect the country for a long time, right? We just opened this segment by talking about a Supreme Court decision. We will likely open many more segments talking about Supreme Court decisions, but it's not just the Supreme Court, all the way down the federal judiciary. McConnell has had an enormous impact on that. And I think the second positive thing, just to start off with the positive, that people have to give him is that he's an extremely effective parliamentarian. When he wants something out of the Senate, it tends to happen. Now, perhaps it's worth pointing out that his resignation comes after that not happening with the border bill, which is perhaps a indication that that power was slipping towards, whether because of age or simply because of that widening delta between what the goals of Mitch McConnell were and what the goals of Republican voters who put Republicans in office, allegedly, were. So in terms of his legacy, I think it's not a good one. In many ways, we've now lived through two populist waves in recent political history in the Republican Party, and many little blips among them, first being the Tea Party, and then obviously the second one being the MAGA revolt in the Republican Party. In between there, we had the 2007 protests under George W. Bush against amnesty and the anti-immigration populist wave. And of course, you can keep going this, like, you know, Buchanan was a protest vote. Ross Perot was a protest vote. There has been for decades, I would say really since Ronald Reagan left office, there has been a widening gap between the priorities of the Republican voter as expressed not only in every poll, but increasingly is expressed in protest, in getting out on the street, which we know, you know, a lot of Republicans are sort of constitutionally opposed to rabble rousing, right? But increasingly disorderly and vociferous protest of the fact that their party simply does not seem to represent them in Washington, does not represent their priorities, often represents the opposite. And that was really obviously true with McConnell. The judges stuff was one aspect where actually what McConnell wanted, which was power trading, lined up perfectly well with what the Republican base wanted. And we saw how effective he was in getting things done in that arena. But the problem is the rest of his priorities just did not line up with the Republican base on any number of issues, whether it was foreign policy, whether it was spending priorities, culture war issues, which he seems to find fairly icky other than the gun issue. He just doesn't seem to have the same. It's not just that he isn't enthusiastic about Republican or conservative goals, it's that he often seems to be at odds with the goals of his base. And that just has not made him a good party leader, even though he was an effective parliamentarian when he wanted to be. Again, I think some people have been doing a little bit of revisionist history on this, saying, well, he didn't have, you know, he worked the best he could with the number of Republican votes that he had. The way that he wielded money among Republican races for the Senate, he made it clear multiple times, both again during the Tea Party and during the populist Trump revolt, that he was a party leader who would rather have fewer Republicans in the Senate than to have more Republicans who disagreed with him on some of these issues. That's not his job, right? He was perfectly free to do that as a senator from Kentucky. That is not his job. He did not, fundamentally, McConnell did not represent us. He didn't represent conservative Republicans. His disapproval ratings for years and years, sometimes decades, has really shown that. And he's a living symbol of the fact that the party establishment in Washington, D.C. is not, often finds their own voters more deplorable and contemptuous and worthy of contempt. And finds those voters' priorities at best something to fundraise over and never to take seriously. I think McConnell was a living, breathing symbol of that. And for that reason, I'm very glad to see him step aside. Now, to get to briefly to his successors, and then I'll turn it out to you, what you think about the legacy of the successors. There's not too much to be excited about in the list of successors. That's always the problem, right? We had that on the House side. Now we have it on the Senate side. excuse me. The list of successors is, you know, John Thune, Cornyn, Rick Scott, who's supposed to be the great conservative hope. I'm not that enthusiastic about. I've heard as a dark horse candidate, Tom Cotton bandied about. That would be definitely out of those names that have been thrown around. I think that would be far superior to any of the other ones. But I'm curious what you guys think about McConnell's legacy and his possible successor.
McConnell was just formidable, and he was always a bad guy to have on the wrong side of whatever you're trying to do, and a good guy to have as an ally. That said, I think he finally hit a wall, especially recently with this push to get Ukraine funding and this joke of his actions on the border. his decision to, you know, go after this bipartisan border bill to, you know, rally support around something obviously flawed, because ultimately his goal was to get money to Ukraine, and really he just personally and single-handedly undermined the Republican negotiating position among his fellow senators, and especially was trying to undermine House leadership. And he had to go. He just had to go. And I think the way to understand his resignation is to see it as he's resigning in 6 months in lieu of being fired right now. Right. He decided that the smart move for him, if he wanted to hold on to any power at all, was to promise a resignation at the next term rather than just get immediately pushed out, because it's clear he had lost the confidence of the caucus. And so if he didn't say something like this, he was probably going to be forced out as a result of this border debacle.
Yeah, and just to bounce off that very briefly, this really is, I think, the beginning of a lot of older leaders in the Republican Party stepping down as we see a new wave of conservatism really take the forefront. I think Senator Feinstein's death late last year was probably the first, and now we have Mitch McConnell, and potentially in 2024, we'll even have President Joe Biden stepping down, and we'll really see the changing of the guard from one generation of Republican leadership and just older leadership across the political spectrum that will be giving away to what is generally far more radical and quote unquote extreme views among the sort of national conservative, new right conservatives that are coming up, as well as the very woke ideological progressive unit of the far left side of the Democrat Party. Both tend to be a little further to the left and to the right than the general Democrat or Republican leadership currently is. And so it'll be really interesting now that these older leaders are stepping down to see what priorities end up being prioritized going forward, but also which leaders are selected to guide us into the sort of new iteration of Democrat leadership and Republican leadership. I think it's probably a really exciting time, and it's been something that has been a long time coming.
I think in terms of the legacy aspect of this, to Inez's point, we'll obviously look to McConnell as someone who knew how to obtain power and wield power effectively. Again, with a caveat on issues that were important to him and largely to the Republican establishment. And conservatives will probably cling to judges broadly as the biggest achievement from McConnell, and obviously, you know, helping prevent Merrick Garland from being a Supreme Court justice. It will obviously be part of the legacy that will echo probably for decades. I will say, though, that it does appear to me, or at least my hope, is that McConnell is choosing to step down. And I think Will is right in terms of what the animating forces were behind it, is that this reflects an ideological shift among Republicans in the Senate, you know, for myriad reasons. The Senate, you would think generally the Republican constituency in the Senate or contingency in the Senate is going to be more moderate than maybe what Republicans would look like in the House writ large. We'll see if ultimately leadership is more attuned to the wishes of not only next generation, but ideologically different set of senators. So whether it's more reflective of, or at least respects the concerns of, the likes of the Cruises, Lees, Hawleys, and Vances, rather than sort of the old guard. But obviously, as Inez noted, you know, the kind of prohibitive front runners here, the assumed successors, are going to be a Thune or a Cornyn, and that would likely reflect more of the same. So I guess the question is, as in the House, and then as with the Republican Party writ large across the country, will our representatives ultimately come closer to representing the marginal conservative voter or not? And then, to the extent they do, can someone who represents conservatives also effectively wield political power in service of our ends? I'm not so sanguine about the Senate, but the younger Turks in the Senate obviously do provide a lot of energy that I think has made a difference. And we see that in Mitch McConnell's becoming a lame duck. So let's hope that augurs further change in a positive direction going forward. On that note, for a completely different topic, I wanted to talk a bit about some other developments in the courts this week, and in part in D.C. with respect to January 6th. And it's worth noting, you know, to level set here, it's remarkable that we're, you know, in 2024, in the throes of an election, and how much January 6th still looms over things among our ruling elite. I said from the start, and I've argued here for months, that January 6th would be used as kind of the catalyzing event in the war on wrongthink, and that the means and measures that would be taken to exploit January 6th would reflect kind of a coming social credit system with American characteristics in this country. And the fact that we're in the throes of an election and it still looms over everything, and you still have people who are being prosecuted, and the DOJ wants to get up to over 2,000 people prosecuted, including, of course, the president in former president in connection with J6, I think tells you how important and how imperative this is for our ruling elites and their efforts to retain power and really put the screws to their political foes. So with that long windup, as we had the Supreme Court dealing a blow to resistance forces, or whatever we're going to characterize them as in this country, there was also maybe a surprising ruling from the D.C. Circuit Appeals Court, where they actually struck down as unlawful sentencing measures that were applied to one January 6er. In fact, there are apparently over 100 cases where this sentence has been applied, where basically what the feds have said and judges have agreed with, because this was a bench case in particular, is that in addition to the whole obstruction of an official proceeding charge, which we can go down the rabbit hole of, there's a sentencing enhancement that's applied for quote unquote substantial interference with the administration of justice. And so basically the DOJ applies this, and judges use sentencing guidelines to extend significantly potentially the imprisonment terms or the sentencing around a variety of J6 cases. And so in this one particular case, an individual who was charged with 2 years in prison, apparently his sentence was extended an estimated 9 months as a consequence of this sentencing enhancement, this interference with the administration of justice. Well, Democrat-appointed judges on the D.C. Circuit ruled that that sentencing enhancement was unlawful, that there was no substantial interference with the administration of justice in this case. And so therefore, there ought to be resentencing for this defendant. And this could potentially lead to resentencing for the 100 plus cases in which this has been. It might affect future sentencing as well. And this is not the first time that the zealous DOJ has been smacked down by the courts. In last August as well, the DC Appeals Court overturned sentencing requests for some convicted of parading in the Capitol, a misdemeanor that's applied in a lot of January 6 cases. And defendants oftentimes got split sentences there, which Will and Inez can probably speak to the legal ramifications of, but basically some time in prison and then some probation time as well. And those split sentences were ruled unlawful, which impacts potentially dozens of cases as well. So all in all, you see that even in DC, which is the most hostile venue and the most vengeful venue probably for anyone and everyone associated with January 6th, at least at the DC Circuit Appeals level, the feds have been struck down. And this, I think, reflects in part the chasm between the effort to politically exploit J6, call it insurrection, et cetera, but not actually charge anyone with insurrection, and then the legal challenges with trying to put the screws to the maximum extent to those ensnared in the J6 dragnet. Now, on the other side of the equation, the legal jihad here continues. This week, the Blaze's Steve Baker, who is a journalist who was present to January 6th, recorded and captured a ton of footage from January 6th, entered the Capitol himself, was in the Capitol for 37 minutes after years of threatened charges. And this is someone, by the way, whose footage has been used by a variety of media sources. He's written dozens, if not hundreds, of articles about the January 6th cases. So he's a legitimate, genuine journalist here. But he attended January 6th and he entered the Capitol and was there for 37 minutes, basically on account of words he used that seemed to be supportive of what transpired on January 6th. He's saying nasty things about Nancy Pelosi, although he says he would have said nasty things about Mitch McConnell too had he entered Mitch McConnell's office, because he's a libertarian. He was slapped with 4 misdemeanor charges. This after threatened charges before, including potentially for some crazy concocted racketeering case. Not only, again, was he charged now several years after January 6th, as, again, one of the most observant journalists and on the riot on this issue, Not only that, but he found himself handcuffed and then in leg irons as well, while he claims that a felon who was also facing a hearing was not in leg irons himself. So this reflects, of course, you know, again, the two-tier selective persecutorial process, it would seem, that those around J6 are being subjected to. It's really chilling. It comes on the heels, by the way, also of Catherine Herridge being held in civil contempt for not wanting to reveal a source in stories that she developed around potential CCP infiltration in America. All of which is saying, despite the fact that the DOJ continues to get smacked down in some ways, on the other hand, the process continues to be more than the punishment for hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans. And I think we should expect still even more desperate measures to the extent they continue getting smacked down. So with all that, curious as to your take on recent developments pertaining to J6 and also what they might tell us about what's going to happen with Donald Trump down the road in connection with J6.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point in hypocrisy hunting. As we all know, this is about hierarchy and not about hypocrisy. But it does strike me that the same people who laud, fund, and staff the Innocence Projects in every major law school have no concerns about blatant due process violations in these cases. And I don't say that actually out of any sympathy then or now for people who broke the law, but it is not sympathy to say that their cases have not been handled, not only with that double standard that Ben is pointing to, which is obvious. And by the way, the case of Steve Baker, I mean, there were New York Times reporters there too. There were plenty of reporters who also went into the Capitol, and it is a very dull 37 minutes of footage of Steve Baker in the Capitol. He essentially like pushes himself up against the wall like a journalist and takes footage. He does not participate in like destroying anybody's office. He is there to record what is happening, and he is being prosecuted for it in a way that his fellow journalists who did the exact same thing are not, because of his political views. And that is like, overall, I agree with Ben, that is the most worrying thing that we keep bringing up week after week on this podcast, this double standard of justice, that is so obvious in January 6th, because as much as I'm in favor of throwing the book at rioters, we all know that the book did not get thrown at rioters for that entire summer of 2020. And that most of those people never saw a day in jail, even though they did much more violent things than many of the people who simply paraded in the Capitol. In any case, I do want to say that, like, even aside from the double standard, there are actual due process problems here. The length of pretrial detention for a lot of these people rises to the level of a due process problem. You know, looking at people's statements, hostile statements about political actors as a sentence enhancement, that is a due process problem, right? So there's a lot to worry about in these convictions. It's not very politically, you know, palatable to talk about, but there's a lot to worry about these, even aside from this double standard. The DOJ has decided that everybody and anybody who is even tangentially connected to January 6th is going to not only receive the full brunt of the law, which is that double standard piece of it, but even we're going to go above and beyond. We're going to try to seam together various offenses in novel ways. We are going to stiffen the penalties in various shady ways that apparently even the DC circuit thinks are questionable. And we are going to make the process, to what Ben said, we're going to make process the punishment. A lot of these people have been through essentially 4 years of punishment before they even serve their actual terms in jail.
Yeah, it seems that part of the punishment here is just this humiliation tactic, the waiting for long periods of time to see if they're going to be sentenced, what the sentencing is, will the FBI come after them? All of this is meant to terrify, to breed uncertainty in their life, but also to humiliate those who were involved in it in a way that, yeah, it has been really very effective. Even if the actual sentences are reversed, it seems that in many ways the damage has been done, and they've really shown just how the sort of contempt with which they hold these people, not only in the sentencing, but as people themselves. And I think something that ties together both the Trump decision and this repeal of J6 sentencing is Jamie Raskin from Maryland, who since January has now been floating some anti-insurrectionist legislation where he's hoping to disqualify insurrectionists from seeking office, so specifically targeted at Trump. If this legislation, which I doubt will pick up too much steam. If it were to go forward, though, this is not only impacting individuals like former President Trump. This would also have long-lasting ramifications for those who were sentenced and who were indicted in this insurrection or following what they called the J6 insurrection. So I think there are a lot of efforts legislatively to continue finding ways to punish people who were involved, not only including President Trump, but also everyone here, even as we're seeing sentences reversed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm friends with Bill Shipley, who represents about 25 J6 defendants. And the big import of this DC Circuit decision is that it reverses a tactic and it stops a tactic that DOJ has been using. Basically, they know they've got an unbelievably favorable jury pool. So when they're bringing in these defendants and they're offering them plea agreements, which they have to take, really, they just know they'd be convicted otherwise. The plea agreements included stipulations to these sentencing enhancements that don't apply. And it's like, it's either you agree to take a sentencing enhancement that shouldn't be applying to your case, or you go to trial. And that's a terrible dilemma to be putting these defendants in. DOJ never should have been doing it in the first place. They should know better, but you see the zeal. I mean, it's just yet another way in which government has been weaponized. It's good to see it stop. Hopefully the Supreme Court stops it further by reversing the way that the 1512C2 obstruction count has been applied. Shouldn't have anything to do with J6. It's about obstruction of justice and, you know, impairing evidence. It's not about, delaying a hearing. That's a very distinct thing. And one hopes that this will come to an end quickly.
All right, so jumping right in with our final segment here, we are talking about in vitro fertilization, a rather niche topic when it comes to the general political discourse that the NatCon Squad talks about, but one that has exploded in the national and state level political discourse. So the summary sort of where we are is back in February on the 16th, the Alabama Supreme Court released a decision declaring that if parents are to suffer the wrongful death of their embryonic children, that they have the right to sue the fertility clinic under the Wrongful Death of a Minor Child Act, holding them accountable for their negligent or careless behavior. Since that decision, however, which recognized that embryos like unborn children can be considered persons under Alabama law, we've just seen an utter explosion, especially from Democrats on the left when it comes to this. They're equating it to Dobbs' decision. They're equating it to Republicans trying to take away in vitro fertilization, stopping families from having the children that they want, things that are all overblown and untrue. But what this has led to is this incredibly, this binary response where either people feel like they have to pledge complete support for IVF, so we're fully in favor of it, no limit. Limitations, we should protect access at all costs, or be painted as an anti-IVF, anti-woman bigot, which is certainly something that no one, especially Republicans going into 2024, want to be framed as. So as of last week in Alabama, the Alabama House and Senate voted to remove all immunity or to provide clinics full immunity from any liability in how in vitro fertilization or embryo storage is practiced in the state. So now parents who are going through in vitro fertilization actually have fewer rights following the vote in the House and the Senate, if it's signed into law, than they did before the Alabama decision. And so we're dealing with an industry, the fertility industry, that's largely unregulated as it is, or underregulated, and is for the most part unaccountable to state or federal law, and typically functions as a self-regulation, where they have the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, who offers guidelines for clinics, but they're largely left to their own devices. And so far, any effort to even provide accountability to the practice of in vitro fertilization has been totally demonized. So we've seen President Trump, Nikki Haley, every major Republican and Democrat leader offer statements voicing their concern for IVF PDF, which certainly mirrors, I think, the majority of Americans as a support for the availability of this treatment. But what's really been lost in the fray, I think, is a nuanced and consistent view, especially among pro-lifers, who would 100% affirm that life begins at conception and is worthy of protection inside the womb. But the moment that this conversation has shifted from abortion into the realm of IVF, parents who desire to create couples, you're seeing a lot of inconsistent responses, even from pro-life groups and pro-life Americans, who are like, well, actually, we should just protect access to IVF, and seem unwilling to get into some of the very real concerns about protecting unborn life from conception when it comes to in vitro fertilization. And so this decision has really thrown, I think, a wrench in how Republicans were planning to approach the 2024 election, and has been a golden opportunity for many Democrats to try to shift voters' attention away from crime, away from the open southern border, away from inflation, the rising cost of basic needs. And instead, Democrats are using this to say, see, Republicans are trying to take away abortion, they're taking away IVF. And this is a real crisis, especially for some of the older women, older single unmarried women, who make up a large part of the Democrat voter base. This is something very popular with them that Democrats are hoping to capitalize on, but in doing so are totally obscuring the facts of the Alabama decision. And instead of actually protecting parents who are struggling with infertility, they're actually setting them up to have no legal recourse in cases where the fertility industry has malpractice.
Yeah, so. I mean, this whole incident has demonstrated to me several things, the first of which is that most people form their opinions based on vibes alone about some of these complicated issues, because I've seen so many people who, unlike me, by the way, claim to be pro-life from conception, but somehow change their views based on whether that embryonic life is being used towards the goal of having children, or in the case of abortion, towards the goal of not having children. In both cases, you're destroying early fetal life. And people have had very different reactions to two different destructions of early fetal life, which is why I say it's based on vibes. But the other thing that has really been highlighted in this for me is the degradation of our moral and ethical discourse, even since George W. Bush, right? When we had the debate about fetal stem cells under the Bush administration, there was a bioethical council, Robbie George was part of it, right? As well as many prominent like liberals and ethicists discussing the implications of this new technology, right? This new ability that had a lot of promise in stem cell research, but also raised ethical questions. What's so disappointing to me is not so much the affirmation of IVF remaining legal in the United States, which, by the way, the United States is basically the Wild West, very unregulated IVF compared to Europe. I mean, even Ukraine, that is famous for very Wild West surrogacy laws, Ukraine has stricter IVF laws, ethical laws around IVF, meaning how many embryos one can create and implant at any given time, other things like that. This is very common in European countries, just like our abortion laws tend to be very, very extreme compared to European countries. That, again, just the quality of ethical discourse and the way that this was just immediately shut down by Republicans terrified of losing another like culture war issue, being hammered the way that they have been on abortion, has been very disappointing to me, not even because I'm particularly against IVF. As I said, I'm a moderate on both abortion and I think something like this, IVF, but you know, fetal life is not even the only obvious ethical issue here. There's a Gattaca-like eugenics ethical issue involved in IVF, which often means you're creating a whole bunch of embryos, then a bunch of them are selected out and destroyed based on what they say is viability. And sometimes it is viability. It's also things like Down syndrome, like various sort of genetic diseases. So you're screening out and destroying embryos based on genetic diseases. Now, that seems like something that we should at least be ethically have a conversation about. And then the ability of potential parents to choose the sex of their child as genetics advances and genetic screening becomes available, especially to people who are on the billionaire range of finances, the ability to screen among embryos for all kinds of things like IQ and height and eye color We are not getting there. We are pretty much there in terms of the technology. Again, this seems like something that we should have a moral and ethical conversation about, what kind of guardrails we want to place on this kind of reproductive technology. And then finally, ethically, there's the issue of the commodification here of human life. So not even to my mind, the status of fetal life, early fetal life, is just one of the ethical discussions that we should be having around this. And we've really had sort of this degraded discourse where the beacon went out on the left and in among the media, and then everybody on the right just curled up into a little ball and said like, oh, no, we're in favor. And Trump, you know, put out a Truth Social that said, no, IVF is great. And all the Republicans said, yeah, IVF is great, right? And maybe it is, but these seem like pretty weighty ethical issues to me that are worth discussing in full the way that we had a conversation about fetal stem cells. These issues are not limited to IVF. We are on a new frontier in terms of creating human life. So now with three parents, separating the function of motherhood from genetic mother to natal mother, so, you know, the function of carrying the child to social mother, right? We've now split motherhood into three parts. We split fatherhood into two. These are serious, weighty ethical questions that a serious society would debate. And we're not having that debate because one half of the debate is too afraid to even step into the arena.
I guess maybe I'm the contrarian here. I don't have very strong moral intuitions when it comes to IVF, but I lean towards the side of IVF seems to help people who can't otherwise have children. I like there to be more children in the world. I think that that's an important feature of IVF that needs to not be lost. But I think more importantly is the world we're dealing with, politically, this is a terrible, boy, is this a terrible issue for us to be pushing IVF bans. And I am like not, you know, essentially we lost abortion bans in Kansas and we lost abortion bans in Ohio that are solid red states. I think that in general, like there needs to be, the groundwork must be laid first before we start going out and legislating on stuff that we are down behind 80-20 on. Because I don't know, this is like, I'm scared about this becoming a broader right-wing issue in the sense before the public has been persuaded of this at all. Because this is a really good way to lose elections and lose the power to do anything. So I'm the contrarian here.
I'll take my remarks and extend them into my parting shot as well. So I would table for purposes of this conversation, kind of what is the pro-life position on IVF or not? And I'm sure there are a wide variety of views on it. I also know that there are substantial differences between US laws and European laws and laws in other countries as well, which might even be more consistent with whatever the pro-life position on IVF may be. But I would actually go to something much more basic and the starting point for this, which is this is the paradigmatic example of how the left latches on to an issue, sets the narrative, immediately puts Republicans on the defensive, and basically with almost none of it having to do with the merits of what actually transpired in Alabama. So when the first the Supreme Court decision came down, the first thing I did upon seeing all the hysteria around it from the commentariat and then Republicans quickly rushing to get out a consistent singular message on it was actually look at what the Alabama Supreme Court opinion said. And here's what the case is about. The case was about an IVF clinic in which a patient walked into the cryo nursery, tried to handle embryos, which are frozen, dropped some of the embryos and destroyed them. I'm sure this was one of the most tragic things that could have happened possible to the family associated with those embryos. So the case was basically about liability and essentially wrongful death of a minor here because of these destroyed embryos. That is the starting point of the case. Now, what did the case deal with, essentially? The only thing that was at issue in this Alabama Supreme Court case was whether the state essentially had pledged to and whether under the laws, essentially, unborn life had the same protection out of utero as in utero. Why? Because Alabama, as a constitutional matter, is devoted to protecting the rights of the unborn. Now, the left loathes that. And if that was the conservative position or the position in every red state in the country, the hysteria might be more understandable. But this is in Alabama, and this is what the Constitution dictates. So it was actually a pretty straightforward ruling of, yes, essentially, there is liability for wrongful death here. And of course, if you were this family, you can never get recompense, essentially, for what transpired there. But no one should be able to walk into a cryo nursery and potentially destroy embryos. So obviously, there was a massive failing in terms of the security in this IVF clinic. Almost no one knows any of those details about what happened in the case because no one reads the opinions, but they let the left dictate what is at play here. And of course, the attorney general in Alabama immediately rushed to say, essentially, that this is not going to lead to the criminalization of IVF in the state. And now, obviously, the legislative branch is acting. The justices themselves said, essentially, we're not ruling here on IVF. And to the extent this is going to create problems, that's for the legislative branch to deal with. But the case itself was relatively straightforward. And I just think this illustrates, once again, how pathetic Republicans are when it comes to the politics, that we let Democrats define an issue, define a narrative, basically without any recognition whatsoever of what the merits are, what the case dealt with, et cetera. But we are perpetually on the defensive instead of on the offensive. And that is separate and aside from the fact that obviously Democrats are going to try to make abortion an issue, that abortion has in some states been a losing issue, at least as Republicans have argued it, that Republicans have not argued it clearly what the Republican position is nationally on this issue, and that the Democrat position on this issue is infanticide. Are Americans for infanticide? No, they're not, overwhelmingly. But set all that aside, I just think this is a paradigmatic example of how bad Republicans writ large are at politics. And then it also, of course, the sophistry of the left, which takes a case like this in Alabama specifically and tries to make it into an issue that it was actually not at issue here. So with that, that's my parting shot, and I'll turn it over to others for your parting shots on probably other issues.
Well, I guess I have one brief other issue, but first I do want to respond. I think actually rare case, Ben, where I disagree with you, and I think it's a bit too coy. IVF clinics are pulling out of Alabama, and that's because the clear implication of this ruling is giving legal status, now that it's reversed, obviously, but by the legislature, but is giving legal status to early fetal life, whether that's in this wrongful death suit that you correctly laid out the facts about. But the fact is that the way that IVF is practiced in most clinics in America inevitably results in the destruction of embryos. I'm pretty with the American people, actually, strangely. Very strange for me. Usually I'm far on the right of various issues than the median American, but I'm quite moderate on abortion and the recognition and value of early fetal life. I don't see it as exactly equivalent to full, you know, personhood. But that is the reality of IVF, and they cannot practice the way that it is currently practiced in the United States with the clear implications of this ruling, which is why they ceased to practice after that. So I do think there are direct responses there. Again, it is amazing to me that as we hurtle at 1,000 miles an hour forward on reproductive technology, which in many ways is a blessing for many people, we are not having a serious conversation, and perhaps this extends far beyond reproductive technology to technology in general, but we are not having serious ethical conversations about the boundaries and the direction of that technology and how it's going to affect, you know, in this case, the genetic profile of future young Americans, how it's going to affect the meaning of human life. Like, we're not having those serious ethical conversations. And yes, I think politically, we're nowhere near ready to have a conversation about banning it. But that doesn't mean this is where we really do feel the lack of having real public intellectuals on the right, even in a way that we did 10 or 20 years ago. You can imagine someone like, for example, like Christopher Hitchens starting a conversation, an ethical conversation about this, because it's worth it. That's just the one piece of early fetal life. There, like I said, there's this huge eugenics piece of it, and a commodification piece of it, like these are weighty questions that a healthy society should be able to have a conversation about, to ultimately come to conclusions about, ethical conclusions, you know, God forbid, ethical conclusions about how we should use certain technology and how that interacts with the dignity of a human being. We don't even have that conversation. We just have totally sidestepped that conversation into, like, you know, echo chambers and yelling, but like even more superficially than usual, and more disconnected than usual from the underlying issues. And that's disappointing to me. My final point is very brief. Don't worry. It's just like two sentences, since I already took up plenty of time. There has been an encouraging sign out of Oregon. Oregon has voted overwhelmingly to recriminalize meth, heroin, LSD, fentanyl, OxyContin, a few other hard drugs. They have left out weed and mushrooms, but everything else more or less is becoming recriminalized after, famously, in 2021, they decriminalized all of those drugs. That seems to be such an obvious failure, that experiment of just letting people shoot up everywhere in most city centers in the United States, but most particularly in the West Coast, Portland, Seattle, and of course, San Francisco and LA. That has been such an obvious disaster, and just humanitarian disaster in terms of people dying from overdose on the streets. There is an overdose crisis in Oregon. And the fact that even people as liberal as the Oregon legislature overwhelmingly voted to recriminalize drugs, I think shows that we are catching up to some of the harms that this libertarian / liberal push to decriminalize drugs has actually caused for especially some of the most vulnerable people in America. So I think that's a nice little bright point to do as a final thought.
I guess I'll switch it up. My final thought is that Nikki Haley managed to prevail in a primary. Finally, she managed to win the DC primary and win all of 1,300 votes, and was publicly cheering it on. It's probably the most embarrassing thing that I could think of for her campaign, to lose every single state but win the few Republicans that live directly in the swamp. If there was anything more telling, it's also telling that the Democrats jumped all over that and pointed out that there were a whopping 600 people in the entire District of Columbia who were willing to pull the lever of Donald Trump, a guy who has 50% support in the broader public. If they could choose a more unfair jury pool for Donald Trump or his supporters, it's just, and even people like Mark Elias and Lawrence O'Donnell highlighted it, how blatantly unfair the jury pool is in D.C. And so I think, you know, this is something Republicans need to start taking care of. Next time we have power, there should be an automatic right of removal for defendants if they want to get out of D.C. and they want to go to, like, the Western District of Virginia to have an actual jury pool of their peers. They should be able to do so.
Yeah, so final comments. I think reiterating everything that Inez said and really concurring there, the one thing that I will push back on is that the clinics in Alabama going back to IVF were not shutting down simply due to the ruling, as the ruling only said they had to provide the best sort of medical care for the embryos that they were entrusted with from the parents. It seems to me that this was largely a politically motivated decision on their part in order to reinforce a particular national narrative, given that Louisiana has had the destruction of all embryos, not just through negligence, as is in the case of Alabama, on the books since the 1980s. And IVF has still continued to flourish in their state, with no clinics leaving or shutting down as a result of it. And similarly, Germany and Poland and Italy have laws in place that limit the number of embryos created or transferred, and yet the practice continues to flourish. So I think that there is a very reasonable place where we can recognize the ethical concerns in the practice, like you laid out so well, Inez, but then also have a conversation about what it looks like to still, of course, maintain access to this treatment that the majority of Americans are in favor of. And so ultimately going into 2024, I think this is going to continue to be a very heated discussion as the question of reproductive rights continues to rule the political narrative.
Well, on that note, on behalf of Will, Inez, and Emma, thanks for tuning in. I'm Ben Weingarten, and we'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.